Do you think Letters to My Children has started breakfast table conversations, water cooler conversations in offices and so forth?
I know that. The most amazing thing to me was having people call and sort of say, you know, letter number 83, we had this fight at our office the other day about X. And I sort of said, and what do you think? I said, it doesn't matter what I think. It's just important to have this, because South Africans tend to be very dogmatic about things we don't know much about. And so as an educator, one of my roles is to sort of say, you know, let's think first before we fight. And let's reflect a little bit on ourselves and others before we simply get into hardline positions. And it's always my hope that whatever I write does that, you know, because it's not important to me what's right and wrong. What is important is that a country that has been censored almost into silence and still threatens to be censored, even by a new government, into silence, has to learn how to speak with confidence about difficult issues.
Speaking of government, number 81 in your book is, your loyalty must never be to a country or a government, but to ideals worth living for.
Right.
So what are the principles that guide your daily life and your decisions?
The notion that I must be able to, for example, feel the pain of the Palestinian mother whose kid was just blown up by an Israeli tank, as I must feel the pain of the Israeli mother who just lost her child from a bomb on a bus in Tel Aviv. And this is not sort of moral equivalence. This is not sort of saying, you know, let's just flatten the world and love everybody. This is sort of saying, can you as a human being feel pain and move from that of people whom you've never met, who don't live within your borders, who don't believe what you believe? Can you feel pain and from that premise begin to talk about what is the approach for change? That is fundamental to who I am, you know, and I hope that my 30,000 students learn that as well, that the Zimbabwean crisis is their crisis, the Ukrainian crisis is their crisis, and therefore, from a leadership point of view, how do you behave?
This is the compassion and openness that people talk about.
Yeah.
Those are the words they use when they talk about you. But it reminds me of something else you write about, and that is when people enter your office, you tell them, in this space, you say that crying is not the sign of weakness. It is actually the sign of strength. Your mother raised you that way. Mm-hmm. And it makes me wonder, what's the last thing that made you cry?
Oh, I cry all the time. The last thing that made me cry was the number of students who come through my office who cannot afford to study, and they're very, very smart, but there isn't enough money in government to fund the growing numbers of kids who seek higher education. And we literally empty our own pockets, my colleagues and I.
Your wife, I know, started a meals program for students.
She started the meals program for students. We go to the, you know, and I get very, very sad when there's a student sitting in front of you and you know this is a first-generation kid and you know the domestic economy can change if she gets that BSc degree and you can't get the money quickly enough, you know. Oh, my God, that's tough. That's really tough. Because, you know, it's not about the scholarship. It's about the hoop that, you know, hangs on a thread. And so we work very, very hard to try and make sure everyone is included. But it's not easy.
You also say, you tell people, don't be intimidated. I don't care how powerful or how wealthy, how popular they are. Do the right thing, basically, is what you're saying. And so I wonder what scares you.
What scares me is running out of time. Running out of time to meet the enormous, you know, need in a country like South Africa, particularly amongst young people, for high-quality education, for a job, for being able to be successful. In other words, not meeting the promise that we made in 1994, that every one of you, black or white, you know, will be able to succeed with a really solid education. That's my, you know, my entire commitment. And the more we load off young people onto the streets because they dropped out of high school in huge numbers, particularly young men, which I know is also a problem in the U.S., and the more they lose hope and the more they no longer believe the promise, the sooner our country will be in very, very serious turmoil. So that scares me. That keeps me awake at night.
Help us understand the South Africa that you know, because so much of what people outside of South Africa are sensational headlines about South Africa being the rape capital of the world, about South Africa being the murder capital of the world, corruption in government, and those sorts of things. Tell us about your South Africa that you know.
Well, all of the above is true, and the sooner we face up to that, the better. But there is another country, you know, inside of that, and that is the country. I wrote a piece once called My South Africa, and it was simply about amazing people, ordinary people, unknown people who have changed the country and keep it going. There is another South Africa. So for every racist attack, I can tell you about white farmers who have given away their land and the training to black people, okay? For every person who has been raped in that very tragic act of violence, I can show you people who've set up a rape shelter, you know, to help young women. And so part of staying sane is not just to read the horrible headlines, true as they are. It is also reading the stories of hope and people's attempt to overcome. And that, for me, is the crucial issue. Because the moment you get those two out of sync, you either become bitter and disillusioned and want to leave the country. If you don't see this part, of course, there's no hope.
You say that overcoming rape, one of the things is that we tolerate, not just in your country, in our country as well, we tolerate bad behavior. And so while we are angry about the rape, why didn't we pay attention when young men were talking a certain way to women,
exactly,
for example?
Or your politicians don't set the example with regard to sexual behavior, or that your police services don't treat the victim with the kind of respect. Or that from day one, in grade one, every teacher talks about respecting other people's bodies. You know, absolutely. And so we tend to react at the point of the crime, and we should react. But what did we build or not build that enables this behavior to persist? And that is the challenge.
You said that in the 50 years that you knew your own father, you never once heard him raise his voice, let alone his hand, to your mother.
Or his children. That was amazing. And that had a huge, huge impact on me, you know, because that was, I mean, he stood out like a sore thumb. People used to call him weak. And at the time, you were sort of embarrassed, you know, and then you realized as you grew up, he was actually incredibly strong because he had the frustrations of any black man in a township, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But he was solidly, you know, ethical and decent in the most difficult of times. That on me as a young black boy growing up had a huge impact on me and allowed me then to raise my own son with the ability to cry, with the ability to care, with the ability to not make choices based on skin or, you know, religion or whatever. And I'm deeply grateful to my father for that.
What did your father do for a living?
Well, everything. You know, he started off working, I think, helping in a cabinet shop, build cupboards. Then he was a hawker selling fruit and veg. But he couldn't sell fruit and veg. This is the interesting thing about him. Because poor people would come to him and say, Mr. Jansen, you know, my ship is coming in next week. Can I just get 6 squash, you know, to feed my family this week? And my dad said, oh, yes, 6 squash. Don't worry, you know, sort me out next time. Of course, next time never came. And so he went bankrupt with that little business because his heart was not about making money, you know.
It was about people.
And at that point, you're angry, you know, because you say, Dad, we've got to eat. You've got to make money, you know. Mom can't be the only one slaving away as a nurse, you know. And as a kid, of course, that's how you respond. When you look back at it, you said, you probably kept a lot of people from hunger's door just by that capacity to give. And that is why both my children are in the helping professions.
They're both teachers.
They both teach, one in a social work context, the other is in a psychology context. Both of them give away most of what they make and so on. And my wife and I do that. But we learned that from my father.
Your father.
So, yeah.
Well, that brings me to Oprah Winfrey.
Yes.
And it made national news when she opened up a school in South Africa for academically gifted girls.
Right.
She got criticized for that. Some said, you should have done that in the U.S. There's a lot of need in the U.S. And she said, in good conscience, she couldn't because the young women she met in South Africa were so eager to learn that she could not do it there. And I'm wondering what impact that school has had on South Africa.
You know, I worked at that school for a few months as a consultant, and I could not believe what I saw. The young women who were there were familiar to me from my work in the townships. They came from homes where they were abused, where they saw their mothers being beat up, where there was no food and so on. And Oprah invested in each and every, she knew everyone by name. She invested in every single one of those kids. She told them, not only will I give you a high quality education, but you will be able to study anywhere in the world at university, and I'll pay for it. That is enormous generosity. And, you know, like most South Africans, I sort of say, oh, you know, who is this loud American woman coming here? I have the deepest respect for Oprah because she made this a personal project. Most people don't know how regularly she flies in and out of South Africa just to make sure those
things are going to
succeed. It is an enormous act of generosity. And that's the point about giving. You don't give because you live in a particular place. You give because there's need somewhere else. Fundamental to America's DNA is generosity. Whatever you might think of your country, the one thing I learned here, yes, it is bellicose. Yes, it likes war. Yes, it likes interfering in other people's business. But fundamental to ordinary Americans that I've met is generosity. The Peace Corps for me is one of the most amazing things, where young people go all across the world and make a difference in sanitation, health, education. I see this. Your country must never lose that capacity to give. And Oprah for me is simply a very prominent example of that tradition of giving across borders and caring for people no matter where they are. And I have really great respect for her.
I want to end with a question we ask everyone who is a guest on this program, and that is, what book have you read recently that you would recommend to others?
You're asking the wrong person, right? Because at any one moment, I read 20 books. So if you came to my home, you'll see 5 books next to the bed. You'll see 6 in the study. You'll see 7 in the lounge and so on. So I'm reading a number. So, for example, I just finished, I think it's Sheryl Sandberg, Lean In, you know, which I thought was an amazing book. I'm reading all Nelson Mandela's books or books about Nelson Mandela. In particular, the books that contain quotes from his life. So there's about 4 such books. That's what I'm busy reading at the moment. So there have got 4 books on my bed where I'm staying right now on Mandela's quotes and so on and so forth. I am an absolute book crazy person. If I get a divorce one day, it's because I spent all my money that I have
time,
left on
all of
books.
Your time.
So yeah, no, I'm a voracious reader and... Lean In, as you know, in your country is enormously popular. It's a book, not just about women for me, it's about leadership, you know, in any context. And then I read both scholarly books, you know, in my field on educational change, Andy Hargreaves' work and so on and so forth, Michael Fullan and others. But I also read nonsense, you know, like these cheap magazines, because I'm absolutely fascinated with the National Enquirer. How is it even possible to make up such a rubbish? Put it out there as news, and I'm interested in what creates that kind of stuff. No, I read everything that's laid before me, and I think the saddest day in my life is if I were to go blind or if I couldn't read, you know, because it brings so much joy.
Jonathan Jansen, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.